Summer will be here soon, and with it, summer reading, a chance to whittle away at that pile of novels accumulating by the bed, passed over in favor of instruction manuals, budget reports, and tomes about the economy. Our first and admittedly early installment in our summer reading series is Colson Whitehead's latest novel, Sag Harbor. It's a coming-of-age tale set among a group of friends in a mid-1980s summer on that predominantly African-American enclave on Long Island. Whitehead's previous works have earned him a Penn Oakland Award, a MacArthur Fellowship, which many people call a genius grant, and he's been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And he's with us now from our studios in New York. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
This is your fourth novel, and you are very clear that it is semi-autobiographical in the sense that your family did spend summers in Sag Harbor, and you did work in an ice cream shop, as does your protagonist. Now, a lot of authors make the sort of semi-autobiographical novel their first outing, and they're criticized for it. So I was kind of wondering if this had been hiding in your drawer until you thought you could say, okay, people know I can write about something other than myself.
Oh, Lord, no. But because it is so common, I did not want to do it. Also, I wasn't equipped. I hadn't done a first-person narrator before, and I didn't really know how to do it until this book, my fourth book. So I needed the sort of maturity and time to figure out what I could use from my life and what to throw out, what makes useful art and what doesn't.
It is funny that you talk about maturity as a way to write about adolescence, because that is such an awkward time. I mean, I don't know anybody who wants to be a teenager again.
Lord knows.
It was
excruciating, but I sort of realized that, you know, just try to do, like, not be self-conscious and just let it all hang out. And once I sort of realized that my horrible squirmings were pretty common, you know, everyone hates adolescence, and if I just be truthful to that time, it'll work. It'll be painful, but it'll work, and maybe we can all laugh about it.
The culture of the 80s, it's almost a character in the book. I mean, who would have imagined that there was so much dramatic material to mine from New Coke, The Cosby Show, Roxanne. Did you cringe as you were revisiting these cultural touchstones, or was it fun?
No, I loved, you know, each second of it. You know, I was trying to figure out what from the summer of 1985 I could use, and luckily New Coke was there and Roxanne. So there are a lot of different weird cultural moments that I was able to unpack, have fun with, sort of tease out their sort of broader implications, so that a new Coke is not just a new Coke. It's actually a horrible paradigm shift in this kid's life. And he has to come to grips with the fact that his world can change. So doing all that research with the music was, you know, incredibly fun.
Okay. And speaking of which, I think we're going to play Roxanne for you, just so you can get into the mood.
I would love that.
Here it is.
Roxanne, can't you understand? Roxanne, I want to be your man. Yo, Kango, I don't think that you're dense, but you went about the matter with no experience.
Don't you want to get a Jerry curl now?
Oh, I think I want to get a tracksuit and a Kangol. I mean, I guess what I loved about UTFO, the folks who did Roxanne, is that they had these village people type characters. And so one was a doctor. The Kangol kid just loved his Kangol. Like, that was his, like, aspect. And it was such an innocent time. And so part of what's great about writing about 1985 is that it captures early hip-hop before it becomes very commercial, before it becomes gangsterized. And it's very quaint and silly. And so it's sort of lovely to see hip-hop in its early days again.
Some of the reviewers have noted your vivid analysis of such important terms as DAG. Now, for those who weren't around in the 80s, you helpfully define DAG as the bitter acknowledgement of the brutish machinery of the world. I'm just wondering if I'm doing it justice in the way. I think you should use it in a sentence.
Well, yeah. I mean, also, you need an audience. Like, if you stub your toe, you don't say DAG. It's DAG is best when someone slams the car door on your hand and you go, DAG. And then someone else says, that was cold. Like, you need someone else, like, you need a witness to this tragedy. And so, DAG, that was cold, is a sort of couplet that was very common.
There's another term that I'm sitting here debating how to describe. It's actually the nickname of one of the characters in the book, NP, and I'm going to pause here to issue a parental advisory here, folks, because NP stands for...
Not necessarily Negro, please, but yes, Nigga, please.
Okay. And I think, again, it has to be said, I'm sorry, I'm wondering if people who've never heard this term used properly will understand how it is meant to be delivered.
Well, in the same way I'm explaining pop culture and the importance of Roxanne, I am trying to have, like, helpful little primers about DAG and Negro, please. And so The character in the book is a clown. He's always sort of making up shenanigans so that basically whenever he says something, the only natural response is, nigga, please. So it's like, you know, I went back to that party and messed around with that girl, and then I went back to her house and she gave me a Rolls Royce. Nigga, please. And so it sticks. And you think that the kids think that they've made it up, but actually his mother ends up calling him that too in a sort of horrible moment.
When they're shocked to discover that a parent, it's like, you know, discovering that parents actually have body odor or something, that they're people. Oh my goodness. You know, mom is actually using this term. It's this moment of shock. I'm wondering, though, if you should have enclosed a CD with the proper use of these terms. That,
well, you know, I try to pick good moments to use in readings. And so I have a whole, there's a thing where I analyze cursing patterns, profanity amongst these teenagers. And so when I do a reading, I have a little chart and I have a helpful pointer and I point out how to use these terms correctly. And so, you know, since I do really enjoy the more humorous parts of the book, I try to find funny things to use in readings. And so there'll be some of that.
And it's interesting because you talked about this being an innocent time. And of course, subsequently, there's been this big discussion about the N-word and whether it's appropriately used and whether, you know, cultural leaders like yourself should pave the way in eliminating this word from our vernacular. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I mean, in my case, it's art. And so I can't say that we didn't use it because we did use it. I certainly, you know, I have a 4.5-year-old and I don't use it in the house. I don't use the N-word around her. And times have changed. But if I didn't put it in the book, I'd be lying about how we used to talk and how we used to be with each other and how the word can have a different sort of meaning in this different context.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Colson Whitehead about his new novel, Sag Harbor. It's the first in our summer reading series. It is. The book is funny and painful in parts. You know, there's the realization that your parents' marriage might not be, you know, what it seems. There's that whole drama around fitting in or not, which in this novel is made even more poignant because it's the whole African-American prep school boys in an all-white school. You know, and the crises are, you know, first kisses and bad haircuts. But the crises are not, you know, getting shot, you know, or getting jumped into a gang. Is part of what this novel does is let people know that there's another reality of black adolescents that isn't boys in the hood?
I mean, that's part of it. I mean, I knew that I had a unique story. I didn't know of anyone who'd written about Sag Harbor, the town in the Hamptons. I was writing about the black community there. So I had free rein to make the story my own. In terms of there not being any shootings or they find a dead body or there's a big fire, a lynching, I want to avoid the traditional coming-of-age melodrama. I want it to be like all of our summers, most of our summers, just sort of we're 0.001% smarter at the end. We have all these hopes that by Labor Day we'll be a new person. But those sort of personality changes are very incremental. And so I was forced to find the drama in small moments and sometimes ridiculous moments, like getting his braces off or getting your first crappy minimum wage job. And what do you do with this fried chicken smell that's on you?
Getting to one of the sections that's painful to read when you talk about like the small moments is a moment when Benji's father, the protagonist is Benji. Actually, I want to call him Ben because one of the issues is he wants to be called Ben, but he somehow can't escape Benji. But Ben's father does not like the way his son reacted to a perceived racial slight at his school. And it is a very painful scene. Do you want to tell us about it?
In the scene, Benji is one of the few black kids in an all-white school. And one of his schoolmates drags his finger down Benji's cheek and says, oh, it doesn't come off, the brownness. And his father gives Benji a lesson in how to respond to the racism in the world and how to stand up for himself.
Do you mind if I say what happened?
Sure, sure, sure.
What happened is his father starts slapping him. And the lesson was, you know, don't let yourself be treated this way. But it's complicated, isn't it? Because Ben doesn't really understand what he did wrong.
No, yeah. I mean, it's about when the parents sort of come in and they sort of come in very slowly. I take my time in sort of revealing who they are and what they're like. He's coming to understand things about the world and things about himself and things about his family, his parents. But he can't really admit them to himself. And he doesn't have a handle on them. So his sort of cluelessness about what it is to be a boy or a man, a black boy or a black man, where it is to live in this kind of household, ends up being part of the drama. And so the reader is sort of pulled along with his slow discovery of what's going on in the house around him and in the world around him.
It is interesting because it's not in your face. I think that there might be some people who would be surprised that the father, who is clearly a professional because they couldn't afford their lifestyle if he were not, would be so adamant about his son standing up for his identity, as it were, right? Basically encouraging his son to throw hands, I think might be a surprise to some people. Middle class parents, prep school, it's always use your words. That's not the way to solve conflicts.
But in the sort of panorama I'm trying to describe, there are well-off Black people going back three generations, first generation college, sort of all sorts of type find themselves in Sag Harbor. And so in the case of Benji's father, he grew up working class and sort of clawed his way to the top. And he is now part of this very bourgeois Black community among some of the same people who wouldn't let him into their club in high school or college. And so, you know, there's a great sort of variety of African-American experience. It's North, it's Southern, it's urban, upper middle class, working class. And part of the fun in the book, or some of the artistic challenge, was getting all these different sorts of people together in one summer and seeing how they rub against each other.
And obviously you're aware of all this talk of a post-racial America in a political context. Do you think that Ben is kind of part of the first post-racial, if there is such a thing, generation?
You know, post-racial is a big buzzword. You know, some serious things have gone down in the last 6 months that have been very startling. And so we do feel that we're on the threshold of a new era. But I don't like to get too sort of Pollyanna-ish about it. I grew up in the 70s and had a different experience with what it is to be Black in America than my parents and my parents' generation. And I hope that, you know, good things are in store for my daughter. And we are making progress in different ways. But I think if we just looked at a pile of Obama's hate mail, we know that actually, you know, we have a ways to go.
Well, finally, thank you for the book. Thank you for your time. I wanted to ask you, as you are starting off our summer reading series, I wanted to ask, what do you read in the summer? What are you planning to read or reread? Do you have any titles that you want to recommend?
Sure. I mean, I always catch up on my reading in the summer. Nathaniel West, Day of the Locust. I think West has a nice way of dealing with pop culture and larger cultural concerns while having a, you know, compelling sort of personal story. Drowned by Junot Diaz. I like its structure. It's short stories, but they're sort of linked. And over the course of the book, you get the main character's life. And so I sort of see it as a novel, but it's very compartmentalized. And I think Sag Harbor has that same sort of structure where there's not a really strong plot, but we're following a boy through different sort of self-contained chapters.
Colson Whitehead, Sag Harbor is his fourth novel. It is available now, and he was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Colson Whitehead, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.